This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Mr. Campbell, we have to end it there, but I'd like to ask you to stay after the show. We'll do a post-show interview and post online at democracynow.org and particularly talk about South Africa and the significance of President Nelson Mandela. Professor Horace Campbell teaches African American Studies at Syracuse University. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable group of people. Mike Berk, Renee Feltz, Aramati, Nirmin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Hani Masood, Ravi.
Station Navigator Report, June 25th, 2013. This weekend, June 28th and 29th, KBOO is participating in the Good in the Hood event, Keeping Unity in the Community. The event is at Lillis Albina Park, located on North Flint and Russell Streets. KBOO will be in the parade on Saturday, serving birthday cake at our booth, and we will also be broadcasting from the entertainment stage Saturday from 2 to 7 p.m. Please listen in or drop by the festivities. On Sunday, June 29th, between 4 and 7 p.m. at the station, there will be a meet and greet for Marissa Anderson, KBOO's 2013 Artist in Residence. Drop by for a beer and snacks and say hello to this special musician who is partnering with KBOO. Thanks so much for your interest and support. This has been Lynn Fitch, KBOO Station Navigator.
Are you a veteran with hearing loss? Saturday, June 29th, Hearing Loss Solutions for Veterans will take place from 8:45 to 5:30 at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. It features workshops, panel discussions, and the newest technology. Lunch will be provided. Don't miss Hearing Loss Solutions for Veterans at 8:45 a.m. Saturday, June 29th at the Oregon Convention Center. Pre-register today at hamiltoncaptel.com/veterans.
The time is now 5:01 and you are tuned into KBOO Portland. And coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, and the KBOO Evening News has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com. Coming up right now, the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon legislature passes a bill to end the abuse of offshore tax havens.
A King County man settles for $3 million for a wrongful police shooting in 2012.
Washington State averts shutdown by passing a budget on the last day of the legislative shutdown.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 28, 2013. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterland. The Washington State Legislature averted a government shutdown by passing a state budget this morning. Legislators announced yesterday that they had reached a deal, but only released the nearly 500-page budget late last night. This morning, the Washington State Legislature passed the budget, which includes $33 billion in spending. The budget increases school funding by $1 billion following a ruling by the Washington State Supreme Court that found the state was underfunding education. Although the state of Washington has never had a government shutdown, it's come close to the wire before in its annual legislative sessions. The state constitution requires that all legislative business must be concluded before midnight on June 30th. This year, the Washington Senate has been controlled by Republicans and two conservative Democrats who've tried to prevent any tax increases. This refusal to compromise has forced the state to include numerous cuts in government agencies in this year's budget. Democrats in Washington state say that they are satisfied with the budget that passed, but urge more funding for education in the next fiscal year.
The Oregon House of Representatives has passed Bill 2406B, which would cut back on offshore tax haven abuse by corporations and wealthy individuals. The bill would require companies to report and pay taxes on this income as though it had been reported from the state of Oregon. The Oregon State Public Interest Group Research Foundation, or OSPIRG, played a heavy role in advocating for Bill 2406B. OSPIRG considers the bill's passage a major victory for their organization and for Oregon's citizens. For more on the story, KABU's Jennifer Camp spoke with Celeste Mefferin from OSPIRG.
The Oregon House of Representatives just passed House Bill 2460B, banning the use of offshore tax havens. What do you think are the implications of this decision?
Well, you know, for too long, Oregonians have waited for Congress to fix the problem of companies, 83 out of the 100 largest publicly traded companies who disguise profits made in the U.S. as foreign income booked to a post office box shell company in places like the Cayman Islands. And so we're really excited then, rather than waiting for Congress to make the first move, Oregon's legislators have taken matters into their own hands. And we're just so excited that the Oregon legislature is protecting ordinary Oregonians from shouldering this additional tax burden.
What does that mean? How would an ordinary Oregonian have to shoulder the tax burden?
Well, when companies use offshore tax havens to avoid paying taxes, the rest of us end up picking up the tab, either with cuts to public priorities or higher taxes. And so, you know, these loopholes put small businesses at a competitive disadvantage and undermine public confidence in our tax system. And so it's really exciting that, you know, Oregon is taking the first step to ending this tax haven abuse.
Okay, can we get a little bit more concrete here with the how exactly ordinary citizens and small businesses are footing the bill for large corporations? Like, what's a really specific example of how that happens?
Well, it all goes back to the budget. So if these large companies are shifting their profits to tax haven countries like the Cayman Islands, then they're not paying their fair share, which means that ordinary people like you or me or small businesses end up shouldering the additional tax burden because we don't have enough money to pay for public priorities. So we either have to cut those priorities or end up raising taxes.
So, for example, large corporations are not paying their Oregon state taxes, but the small store down the corner is?
Exactly. And not only are the small businesses paying their fair share, but they actually have to compete with large corporations who aren't paying their fair share. So they're put at a competitive disadvantage as well as having to shoulder the additional tax burden.
So you sort of answered this, but let's get into it a little bit more. Who typically makes use of tax havens and why are they problematic?
So our research estimates that 83 research shows that 83 out of the 100 largest publicly traded corporations are using offshore tax havens to avoid paying their taxes. So this use of these offshore tax havens is perfectly legal, but it isn't right. That's why Oregon legislators took the first step to ending this offshore tax haven abuse, so that these companies actually have to start paying taxes on their profits.
So whereas it used to be legal with the passage of the bill, it is now illegal?
Well, what the bill does in Oregon is essentially requires that companies add back in their income that they have shifted to tax haven countries. And so they have to add it back in as taxable income in the state of Oregon. Technically aren't paying federal taxes on that, on those profits.
So they can still file from an offshore tax haven, but it won't save them any money because they still have to pay the Oregon state taxes anyways as of the passage of the bill?
But they don't have to pay taxes on it. So what the law in Oregon does is it requires them to add back in the income that they've listed on their federal return as income in tax haven countries and actually specifies the countries that we're talking about in the Oregon law, and it requires those companies to add that back in to the taxable income for the state of Oregon.
Osprey just had a huge win with the passage of the bill, but corporations and wealthy individuals nationwide use offshore tax havens. In light of this, what are the next steps for your organization?
So that's a great question. You know, and this definitely, I want to just underscore that this is still a huge problem in the state of Oregon. We're estimating, the Legislative Revenue Office estimates that this will bring, or keep, I guess, technically $20 million in state coffers every year. Our research estimates that we might be losing up to $283 million from corporations not paying their taxes. So this is only fixing part of the problem. And then, as you say, it is a large problem across the country. And we are part of a large network of organizations, the state PIRGs all across the country, who are looking to Oregon now to see if this is something that they might be able to pass in their own state in the future.
So Oregon is the example that other states you think should follow?
Yeah, and actually Oregon is using a model created in the state of Montana, actually, who, you know, about, I think, 5 years ago passed a law just exactly like the one that was just passed here in the state, and they're already seeing millions of dollars back into the state.
Well, that's about all the time I have today, but thanks so much for speaking with me, Celeste.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
This is Jennifer Kemp with KBOO News.
This morning, the Oregon House passed a bill to study the costs and benefits of single-payer and other health care funding options in the state. The bill, HB 3260, still needs to be approved by the Senate before it goes to the governor's desk for his signature. Here's a sample of the testimony from this morning's hearing.
The good news is that under the Affordable Care Act, starting in 2017, Oregon will be able to modify its healthcare system and tailor it to fit what is best for us as Oregonians. What exactly does House Bill 3260 do? The healthcare study bill requires the Oregon Health Authority to oversee an objective, professional study of four potential models for providing healthcare coverage to Oregonians. The study will evaluate and compare, first, what happens if we just stick to the current Affordable Care Act, including private insurance sold on the healthcare exchange? Two, what if we have a publicly funded option sold on the exchange along with private insurance? Third, how about a publicly funded system similar to Medicare, where coverage is not directly connected to employment? And finally, how about an option for a plan open to all, but which would be limited to covering only essential health benefits?
Mike Moore from Healthcare for All Oregon spoke with KBOO from Salem after this morning's vote.
HB 3260 is a study bill. It asks the Oregon Health Authority to study up to four different ways of financing healthcare in the state of Oregon, which includes the way we're doing it now and includes using some kind of taxing mechanism to enable to support the people buying private health insurance, and also includes a publicly funded state-run health care. We promoted it because we believe that, single-payer is easily the most cost-effective. It cuts out a lot of the waste that is inherent in our current system of financing, where a lot of money is siphoned off by private for-profit and not-for-profit insurance companies that is not actually going to providing care for people. Every study that's ever been done by any source has shown that single-payer is by far the most cost-effective way of delivering high-quality care. But single payer is just a, as the name implies, it's just having one payer. So if you go to your doctor, you go to any doctor you want to, just like you do now. Actually, you probably would have more choice because a lot of times now, depending on where you get your insurance, your choice of doctors is restricted. Under a single payer system, your choice of doctors wouldn't be restricted, or your choice of healthcare practitioners wouldn't be restricted. So you go to your practitioner. And instead of that practitioner having to sort of fill out you know, a bunch of different forms for whatever insurance company you have versus whatever insurance companies all their other patients have. They just fill out what they just bill the government. Private insurance companies essentially, you know, killed Measure 23, which was an attempt in Oregon about 11 years ago to enact a single payer system that actually was doing very, very well in the polls up until about 3 to 4 weeks before the election, and then the insurance companies spent very, very heavily on negative advertising and swayed enough voters the other way.
That was Mike Moore with Healthcare for All Oregon. Their website is hcao.org.
A Multnomah County judge has upheld the $35 per person arts tax as constitutional in the measure's third legal challenge since it was passed by voters last November. Lewis and Clark Law Professor Jack Bogdansky, known for Jack Bog's Blog, filed the first case against the city that was thrown out by a judge. Bogdansky said the arts tax constituted a head tax, which would violate the Oregon Constitution. After he lost his case, Portland resident George Whitmire filed another lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the arts tax, but a judge has again upheld the tax, saying that it is not a head tax, since it does not charge per capita, but only applies to people who make more than $1,000 per year. The arts tax was due on June 10th, and the city of Portland says it has already collected over $7 million. The money will go to arts programs in schools as well as to nonprofit arts and music groups, including the Oregon Symphony.
Yesterday, King County reached a $3 million settlement with an Auburn, Washington resident who was shot during a police raid last year. In February 2012, King County officers shot Dustin Theo Harris while he was in bed. King County deputies and state correction officers were searching for weapons following the arrest of one of Theo Harris's roommates for a parole violation. Officers fired 20 times into his room and believed he was reaching for a weapon. Theo Harris, who was unarmed, was hit 16 times. He was not under suspicion, nor had he committed a crime. Though he survived the assault, he incurred a spinal fracture, limb and organ damage, and his jaw and shoulder were shattered. The King County Sheriff's Office and the Washington State Department of Corrections both ruled the shooting was justified. The $3 million settlement only resolves Theo Harris's dispute with King County. Theo Harris is still pursuing legal action with the Washington Corrections Department. According to the Seattle Times, King County will not prosecute the deputies and correctional officers who shot him.
Portland police are looking for a person of interest in connection with two incidents of racist graffiti on a synagogue and a Jewish community center in southwest Portland. Both sites were spray-painted with the words "White Power." Portland police say that they suspect the same person was involved in both incidents. The police say they've deployed bias crimes detectives on the case, but have no leads apart from a man in his early 20s wearing a black beanie cap who was spotted in the area around the time the graffiti was discovered. Although groups like Rose City Antifa have documented white supremacist organizations in the Portland and Vancouver areas, Pete Simpson, a Portland police spokesman, said that there aren't really any white supremacist groups in the Portland area to speak of. Simpson added that these incidents are usually the action of an individual.
The Oregon Department of Agriculture has decided to restrict the use of 18 pesticides for 6 months. This restriction follows an incident 2 weeks ago in which 50,000 bees died after ingesting pesticide in Wilsonville. The ban will remain in place as the department conducts an investigation into the death of the bees. Mace Vaughn with Xerxes Society in Portland spoke with KBOO News about the recent bee die-off and the state's temporary ban.
We were contacted from a number of concerned citizens who were shopping at the Target in Wilsonville who said they just saw bumblebees raining down from the trees, dying on the pavement 2 weeks ago Sunday. So we instituted an investigation on Monday, went to the site, saw the thousands of bees littering the parking lot, and then contacted the Oregon Department of Agriculture to alert them and to get an investigation going. What they've subsequently discovered is that a landscaper working at that parking lot had treated those trees with a systemic insecticide right as they were being right as the blossoms were opening. And so that was 55 trees going into full bloom. These are linden trees that are very attractive to bumblebees and honeybees and a number of other pollinators. And as a result, we've had this sort of immediate, acute, dramatic bee kill there. It's the largest documented killing of bumblebees, native wild bumblebees, at any site in the U.S., in U.S. history that we know of. Safari is the pesticide product that was sprayed on these trees, both at this Wilsonville site where we saw this very dramatic bee kill, but also in downtown Hillsboro where we've seen a smaller bee kill. The active ingredient is a product with a big name called dinotefuran, and they've specifically banned the application or the use of that neonicotinoid, dinotefuran, for the next 6 months, which I think signals two things. First of all, that they've got some pretty significant concerns about this product and whether or not the labeling that's on the pesticides, on the insecticides that people would buy at the store or that commercial applicators would use, I think they've got Oregon Department of Ag has some very serious concerns about whether that label language provides enough information to be protective of bees and other pollinators. I feel like, and many people I've talked with feel like, we've all just seen fewer bumblebees this year in general, and fewer bees in general, and certainly feel that the public needs to continue to engage and, you know, do things like join, for example, Xerces Society has a Bring Back the Pollinators campaign. We're really pushing people to, you know, go out there and plant the flowers and the shrubs and the trees that bees need to get the pollen and nectar that, you know, fuels their growth, fuels their reproduction. You know, people need to be using fewer and actually stopping the use of insecticides for all ornamental and cosmetic purposes in the city.
That was Mace Vaughn with the Xerces Society for the Protection of Invertebrates. The ban includes 18 pesticides, which are mainly used by professional gardeners. It will not impact pesticides used for flea, tick, ant, or roach control.
Well, you're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counter Spin after this newscast, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather forecast is for a high of 87 degrees, an overnight low of 65, and on Sunday, expect highs in the mid-90s. Summer is here.
It's 5:22, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
We have a serious housing shortage in America these days, and the stress it's creating for needy families is approaching heart attack levels. Did you know, for example, that the inventory of million-dollar homes in Carmel, California, is down to only 4 properties? That's a 76% drop in only 1 year. But the tragedy doesn't stop there, for this is a cross-country crisis. Consider the poor people in Old Greenwich, Connecticut, where only 10 homesteads in the million-dollar range remain on the market. Yes, my friend, it's not merely the poor and middle class who can't find suitable housing, but many of our wealthiest citizens are hurting too. What's happening here is a surge of multimillionaire hedge funders, Silicon Valley high-techers, oil and gas frackers, and other super-richers who are in a frenzy to snap up luxury second, third, and fourth homes. More disturbing is the influx of flashy Russian, Middle Eastern, and Asian tycoons grabbing high-end homes like they're M&Ms, shutting out our homegrown rich. So where the hell is Congress? Any immigration reform worthy of the name would set quotas to protect our own. And doesn't this crunch in the ultra-wealthy housing market just cry out for a mansion construction subsidy? If our national leaders won't help the most privileged among us, who will they help? The situation is so dire that many of the moneyed elites are being forced to scrounge around like commoners to find rental properties. Luckily, there are some swell homes still available out in the Hamptons, renting for about $1 million. For the summer, that is. Yes, that's almost $10,000 a day, not counting utilities and the pool boy's salary. But in tough times, the rich tend to toughen up, reach for their wallets, and do what has to be done. This is Jim Hightower saying, and after all, isn't that what makes America so exceptional?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The trial of George Zimmerman continued today in Florida. Zimmerman is accused of second-degree murder in the shooting of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Today, a neighbor who witnessed the scuffle leading up to the shooting said he saw a figure in dark clothing straddling another man. The description of the man on top appeared to match the teen. Yesterday, the court heard testimony from another neighbor and the woman who was on the phone with Martin during the lead-up to the shooting. The trial will continue into next week.
Military prosecutors in the trial against Bradley Manning revealed new details about some of the diplomatic cables the Army private leaked to the anti-secrecy group WikiLeaks. Prosecutors submitted more than 100 cables from embassies around the world in evidence and called on testimony from State Department officials who described how the cables were classified. Manning, who faces numerous charges, including aiding the enemy, could receive a life sentence. For the latest, we're joined by journalist Kevin Gostola, covering the Manning trial for FireDogLate.com.
Thank you for having me.
This week, the prosecution provided more information about some of the diplomatic cables Manning provided to WikiLeaks. They come from U.S. embassies in Baghdad, in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and Moscow. What are in these cables?
Well, from looking at them at a glance, these aren't any of the cables that The Guardian, The New York Times, Der Spiegel, as far as I can tell, the international newspapers that covered different cables, the ones that received a lot of attention that anyone in the public might remember, those do not appear to have been charged. So just for an example, there's a cable from Sana'a, Yemen, on Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was the president, talking about in a meeting with General David Petraeus that they would agree to say that those bombs are ours and not yours. He was referring to U.S. drone strikes, talking about covering up that the U.S. was engaged in counterterrorism operations with drones. And that's not one of the cables charged. What we have is 117 cables. We've got 96 that were classified at the confidential level. We've got 21 from there that are secret level. And so these cables, if you look, are pretty standard reports that diplomats would send out. I spoke with Peter Van Buren, who was a 24-year veteran, a former Foreign Service officer who had been in the State Department. And he just said from his experience that most of the cables he was seeing were pretty standard. There wouldn't necessarily be anything significant to them. Anything sensitive would have been classified at the top secret level, or they would not have wanted them to be able to be pulled from a Freedom of Information Act request, so they would have had sensitive information exchanged over the phone. But typically, the information wasn't as critical, in his opinion.
So, according to the government, 96 of these cables considered to be classified, 21 secret. How does what the prosecution is disclosing about these cables fit into its case against Bradley Manning?
These are he's charged with willfully communicating these cables to WikiLeaks, which was unauthorized to receive them. That makes up one of the Espionage Act charges. Outside of that, it goes to the more general issue of wantonly causing intelligence to be published on the internet and also aiding the enemy, because a lot of the information, if you look at it, specifically if we go to like Kabul, Afghanistan, you can look and see that the cables that were charged involve Afghan border police. They involve formations of a militia to make up for a shortage of Afghan security forces. Another cable talking about Afghan national police reform. So you can see that these are, I guess the State Department diplomats would argue that these were critical to securing the areas where U.S. soldiers were fighting, bringing peace to Afghanistan. And I think that could go towards the government's argument there that by disclosing these cables, Manning was disrupting that effort.
Kevin Gustoli, you report on Manning's careful deliberation when deciding what to release and what to keep from the public. Talk about how Manning has described that process.
For the diplomatic cables, he came across them and became fascinated because he was really into the different geopolitical issues that were in that he was reading about, able to read about at all the diplomatic posts. Not just Iraq, but all over the world, he said. There are very conscientious decisions that went into each of these disclosures, according to Manning.
And the defense will have an opportunity to present their case soon. Kevin Gustola at the Fort Meade, Maryland, court-martial of Bradley Manning. What's next in this process?
Next week, I expect the prosecution will be resting its case, which means that the defense the following week, because we are going to have a 4th of July holiday break. So in the next week, the defense would come forward and they would begin their case. There's no information at this point on how long that would be. And then following that, I believe we go straight into sentencing because the military will offer up the conviction and the sentence at about the same time. So we go into the sentencing phase of the trial, and we begin to hear witnesses who will talk about the nature of the information to go towards his punishment. And the same will go for the defense. We'll talk about the nature of the information to hopefully reduce any punishment.
That's journalist Kevin Gustola. He's covering the Bradley Manning court-martial of Fort Meade, Maryland. He's covering it for FireDogLake.com. You can find his updates there. He's also the co-author of Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. Kevin Gustola, thanks so much for keeping us informed and up to date.
Thank you.
And to hear an extended update from Kevin Gustola with more details from this week's court-martial of Bradley Manning, go to FSRN.org.
Investigators are exploring whether a retired Marine Corps general leaked information to media outlets in 2010 about efforts to disrupt Iran's nuclear enrichment program with a computer virus. James Cartwright reportedly designed and managed an operation dubbed Olympic Games, in which cybersecurity agents from the United States and Israel infected Iranian nuclear program networks with the Stuxnet virus. At the time, Iranian officials contended that Western interests were responsible for the cyber attack. Cartwright was known during his tenure at the Pentagon as an early advocate of cyber warfare missions within the Defense Department's top officer corps. The former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff remains involved with and on the board of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington-based defense think tank.
Following the passage of a comprehensive immigration reform package by the U.S. Senate yesterday, the U.S. House of Representatives Judiciary Committee has approved the act titled Supplying Knowledge Based Immigrants and Lifting Skills, or Skills Visa Act. The bill would more than double the number of available H-1B visas for highly skilled foreign workers and add 55,000 more green cards for foreign graduates of American universities. In turn, the House Judiciary Committee's bill would eliminate the diversity visa and siblings of U.S. citizens' green card programs. The diversity visa is better known as the green card lottery. Silicon Valley companies are currently facing an employee shortage as fewer Americans are graduating with the desired skills. According to PC World, California Republican Representative Daryl Issa, one of the bill's main sponsors, said the bill would benefit the U.S. economy and help American job creation. However, Asian Americans Advancing Justice, or AAAJ, wrote the House Judiciary Committee a letter criticizing what they called pro-business, anti-family legislation.
Student loan interest rates are set to double from 3.4% to 6.8% on Monday because Congress did not act on the issue before leaving Washington today for a week-long 4th of July vacation. The White House estimates more than 7 million students will owe an extra $1,000 on average every year just in interest on their loans. Democrats in the House and Senate have introduced proposals to extend the lower rate, but the only bill that has advanced in Congress is a House Republican proposal that passed last May. That bill would tie federal student loan interest rates to the government's cost of borrowing. Under that plan, interest rates could fluctuate from year to year up to a high of 8.5% for undergraduate and 10.5% for graduate students. Nearly every Democrat, including Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, voted against the bill, saying it would increase the current debt crisis and create uncertainty for students and their families. Pelosi told reporters on Thursday that the government should invest in making college affordable for everyone.
Just days after the groundbreaking repeal of the Defense Against...
Nothing brings more money to the Treasury than the education of the American people, whether it's early childhood, K through 12, higher education, postgrad, lifetime learning. So by making college cost more for families, we're not only hurting families, we're not only hurting our economy, we're hurting our budget as well. They're trying to use a student to reduce the deficit, but in the end, again, nothing reduces the deficit more than investing in education.
Over in the Senate, a group of Democrats introduced the Keep Student Loans Affordable Act this week. Co-sponsor Elizabeth Warren explained Thursday what the legislation would do and why it matters.
The fundamental issue is whether or not the United States government should be making a profit off our students, making billions of dollars in profits off our students. We here are committed to wringing those profits out of the student loan program. That's going to be a two-step process. The first step, we need a one-year patch to keep interest rates from doubling on new loans. That buys us the time to go to the second part, and that is that we commit to developing a comprehensive plan to reducing the $1 trillion of student loan debt that's already outstanding and helping bring under control the rising costs of college.
The profit Warren mentioned was detailed in a recent study by the Congressional Budget Office, which found that the federal government is set to make more than $50 billion this year off student borrowers. Warren and her co-sponsors hope to write some more systemic reforms of tuition costs and loans into law when the Higher Education Act expires in September.
Just days after the groundbreaking repeal of the Defense Against Marriage Act, Michigan Judge David Lawson is overturning a ban on granting benefits to people in domestic partnerships. The ban, passed by Michigan's Governor Rick Snyder in 2011, affected public school and local government employees. Lawson condemned the ban as unconstitutional, claiming that denying benefits of people to domestic partnerships or forcing them to purchase expensive private health insurance was a direct violation of the Equal Protection Clause. The case began in 2011 when five same-sex domestic partnerships filed a complaint against the governor claiming discrimination. The case went on to federal court, where Lawson ruled in favor of couples. According to Lawson, the law served no other purpose than to punish gay people.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, neighboring Pakistan has granted continuing refugee status to the millions of Afghani refugees living in the country. Refugee status was due to expire on June 30th, but according to the United Nations Refugee Agency, it'll be extended until Pakistan comes up with an official refugee policy. Also today in Afghanistan, an International Security Assistance Force service member died in the eastern part of the country of non-combat causes.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jennifer Kemp, Ross Freeman-Levin, Ren Green, and Robin Ryan. Special thanks to reporters from FSRN. More of their stories can be heard at fsrn.org. Our engineer tonight is Ian Gadberry. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Coming up tomorrow morning, Saturday morning, that would be actually Monday morning, on KABU at 7 a.m., it'll be Democracy Now! With award-winning journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 a.m., hear more talk radio with Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott. At 9 on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Bill Resnick talks with John Bellamy Foster about the leftist strategy to lower greenhouse gas emissions and transform production towards a steady state, no growth economy. Also, there will be a review of the new documentary Blacking Up, hip-hop's remix of Race and Identity. At 10 a.m., hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Barbara Bernstein hosts Locus Focus, a weekly interview show about our place on the planet. At 11 a.m. on Health Watch, host David Nyman interviews family physician Daphne Miller, author of Pharmacology, which is based on Miller's travels to discover the hidden connections between how we care for our bodies and how we grow our food. And at 11:30, it's Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health with host Will Hall. Thanks to all of you KABU members for your generous support. If you're not a KABU member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm. Stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Robert.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, Barack Obama gave a major address on climate change. What it signaled, rhetorically or otherwise, was very much up for debate. The media discussion included plenty of Obama's critics in the fossil fuel industry, but what were the environmentalist critiques of the policy? We'll talk to Public Citizen's Tyson Slocum. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
The story of NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden has become in some ways a story about the reporter who broke the scandal, Guardian columnist Glenn Greenwald. The question, to some in the media, is whether Greenwald is involved in a crime, or more specifically, how involved he is. Here's NBC host David Gregory posing that question to Greenwald directly.
To the extent that you have aided and abetted Snowden, even in his current movements, why shouldn't you, Mr. Greenwald, be charged with a crime?
Now, as you might imagine, Greenwald took issue with the idea that a journalist would ask that of another journalist. Gregory protested that he was just asking a question, but that's a bit much. The preface, to the extent you have aided and abetted, assumed Greenwald was guilty of something. And it wasn't just David Gregory. Here's New York Times reporter Andrew Ross Sorkin talking about Snowden and Greenwald on CNBC.
I would arrest him, and now I'd almost arrest Glenn Greenwald, who's the journalist, who seems to be out there. Almost, he wants to help him get to Ecuador or whatever.
Now, Sorkin apologized, or almost apologized, if you will, for putting it that way, though it wasn't entirely clear what it was he meant to say. But the revelations, along with the subsequent newspaper stories delving into Greenwald's personal life, are making it pretty clear that some journalists want to show that Glenn Greenwald isn't one of them, which, of course, he's not.
It looks like we're on to the next phase of the Snowden saga. anonymous government officials going to compliant media outlets to complain that his revelations have made it easier for terrorists to evade capture. A June 25th piece in the Washington Post included several anonymous U.S. officials. One guaranteed that the Russians and the Chinese had seen Snowden's files. More ominously, though, another unnamed official tells the paper that Snowden's leaks helped the terrorists. As the Post put it, several terrorist groups in various regions of the world have begun to change their methods of communication. That was seconded by CNN Pentagon reporter Barbara Starr, who likewise relied on unnamed U.S. officials making the same claim. And then, from the Associated Press, the headline, Al-Qaeda said to be changing its ways after leaks. The report dramatically claimed that U.S. intelligence agencies are scrambling to salvage their surveillance of Al-Qaeda and other terrorists. Relying on sources who, again, cannot be named, the AP reports that, quote, members of virtually every terrorist group, including core Al-Qaeda members, are attempting to change how they communicate based on what they are reading in the media, close quote. Now, if this was really happening, you have to assume government officials would say so on the record. Instead, we have secret official sources telling us about a secret program and how a whistleblower is giving terrorists an advantage. Perhaps a little skepticism is in order.
The Washington Post's editorial page reaction to Ecuador considering asylum for Edward Snowden was predictable. The June 25th paper declared, quote, when it comes to anti-American chutzpah, there's no beating Rafael Correa, the autocratic leader of tiny, impoverished Ecuador, close quote. Now, Correa is also the overwhelmingly popular democratically elected president of a country that has experienced remarkable economic growth over his time in office. But for the Washington Post, his main mission is ticking off the United States. The paper slams Correa on press freedom. Quote, some might find it awkward to be granting sanctuary to one country's self-proclaimed whistleblower while stifling their own. Not Mr. Correa, close quote. Likewise, some might find it awkward to righteously decry another country's lack of press independence while dutifully caricaturing one's own state's designated enemy. But not the Washington Post. The paper goes on to suggest a little economic strong-arming in the form of letting some trade benefits expire as response to Ecuador's supposed Yankee baiting. If this all sounds familiar, it's because it was a virtual cut and paste of the paper's editorial almost exactly 1 year ago, blasting Rafael Correa for considering asylum for WikiLeaks Julian Assange, and suggesting